Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today's date is August 21st, 2002. Today's session is Economic Globalization and Christian Neighbor Love. Globalization, what is it? Presented by Cynthia Mo Libita, number MOC 2002-06. Let's listen in.
Is not just verbal, but it's art and music and dance and poetry, so maybe you're demonstrating how some of the language of ethics is some forms of craft. We'll see how that plays out. We will begin. I'm Cynthia Mo Libita, and this is the second in a series of five sessions looking at economic globalization as it relates to Christian neighbor love. The title of today's session is quite simply, What is Economic Globalization? Before we begin, I would like to take a moment to remind us that whenever we come together to think critically and to share honestly and to probe realities that we need to see clearly, to hear each other and to respect each other, all for the sake of living in the ways of Jesus Christ, that we walk on holy ground. Let us recall that we walk on holy ground by lighting a candle. And remember, a candle is a truly rare thing in the village these days. And I'm placing it in the midst of this incredible piece of art. How many of you were here yesterday in the initial session? Or how many of you were not? Let's put it that way.
Whoa, word spread.
That's a lot. Let me take just a couple of minutes then to review where we were yesterday, to contextualize today and yesterday. And for those of you who were here, this will be we'll do this very briefly. We started out just naming our vocation. Our vocation as people of the God whom Jesus loved. And we noted that that vocation may be seen very specifically as we are called to receive the love of God and to live that love out into the world. We use the words love neighbor as self to express the reality of living the love of God out into the world. That is our vocation, our calling here on earth, to receive God's boundless love and then to live it out. I would dare say that most of us long to realize, long to live that vocation. We looked at the particular wilderness, the particular place of lostness and wandering and devastation and sometimes despair in which we live when we're called to love neighbor as self and yet are somewhat captive to or forced into participating in the ways of life of a globalizing economy that structure exploitation into the everyday practices of our lives. Exploitation of other people who may be poor and exploitation of the earth. It's clearly a very controversial and contestable claim for me to say that exploitation is structured into our lives. I would go beyond that even to say that we are, by virtue of how we live economically, we are structured enemies of many who are poor and of the earth itself. We could and will spend time examining aspects of that claim. I don't ask you to necessarily agree with me. I ask you to probe the implications of if that is true and to see how it plays out to be true or not true as this week goes on. We read a couple of statements to sort of symbolize or illustrate that dual claim, that we live in ways that structure exploitation into our lives, both of people and of other than human creation. One of the things that we read was from the United Nations Development Program, its Human Development Report. I won't reread that, but I'll state the end of it. And the end of it, the report ends by saying that globalization marginalizes the poor within countries and between countries to the extent that today the 225 richest people in the world have assets that exceed the income of the lowest 47% of humankind. Did that come out straight? Did you hear it?
Yes.
Okay. 225 people have assets that exceed the income of 47%. The three most wealthy people on Earth have assets equal to the wealth of 48 nations, the 48 poorest nations. This is a result of the way that we have structured economic life on this Earth according to the dominant paradigm of economic globalization. The other statements that we read concern the ways in which, should have brought them with me, I didn't know there would be so many people here who haven't been here before. Let me just see. Here we go. Listen to this. According to a State of the World report, biodiversity is the basis of our existence. However, like the dinosaurs 65 million years ago, humanity now finds itself in the midst of a mass extinction, a global evolutionary convulsion with few parallels in the entire history of life. Most estimates are that at least 1,000 species are lost per year. But unlike the dinosaurs, we are not simply the contemporaries of a mass extinction, we are the reason for it. Reversing this trend calls for restructuring the global economy. The fate of our children depends upon it in ways we can barely begin to conceive. According to the Development Dictionary, if all the countries followed successfully the industrialized example, which is part of the aim of globalization, to spread the industrialized example of economic growth about the globe. If all of the countries follow that example, I quote, 5 or 6 planet Earths would be needed to serve as mines and waste dumps. And then finally, in short, economic growth, the aim and promise of globalization, has collided with Earth's natural limits. Economic growth together with population growth threatens Earth's capacity to regenerate. The words blandness dim the stark reality. While human life depends upon Earth's life systems, every natural system on the planet is disintegrating, and the human species is the cause of it. If current trends continue, as Roman Catholic ethicist Dan McGuire says, we will not. I read you those statements as a way simply of illustrating and having us enter into this claim that the way we live as a species economically isn't sustainable, can't go on. Wendell Berry, is anyone familiar with Wendell Berry's book, The Great Work? Wendell Berry states that every age of people has its great work before them. And the great work of our age, our great work, is to change the relationship between the human species and the planet from one to a relationship of sustainability. In other words, the task before us is to create sustainable Earth-human relations. A part of that task is to redesign, to restructure economic life, the globalizing economy. Now, to me, it is a wilderness to live within that contradiction, that my shirt may have been made in a sweatshop, my strawberries may have been grown on land where people need the land to grow food for their people. I was a missionary in Honduras for 2 years, and I saw the kids with whom I worked literally malnourished, classically malnourished, not because their parents didn't have the burning desire to work and feed their kids, but because their parents couldn't get even un pedacito de tierra, which means a small piece of earth, on which to grow beans and corn to feed their kids. the earth was owned by foreign companies for exporting beef and bananas and such. To me, it's a wilderness to be called to love neighbor and to live with those realities. Now, it seems to me, and this is the end of the rehearsal of yesterday, it seems to me that we have a number of options. One is, and a very, very common one, is to run away from knowing, to run away from seeing, to run away from letting these kinds of realities sink into our consciousness. Are any of you very familiar with that option, either in yourselves or people you know?
Oh, yeah.
I'm very familiar with it. Another option is to sink into despair. To sink into despair and hopelessness so great that we might even choose not to continue living. Do you know people, perhaps particularly young people, who have sunk into despair about these realities? I did at one time in my life. Another option is to see, but to decide that we can't do anything about it. We can't make a difference. It's too big. We can't be part of this great work, and instead we'll be as good and as kind as we can in our personal lives. Just flee into personal morality and stay just there for the living out of neighbor love. Is that a familiar reality to anyone here? And it's incredibly important to live out our personal reality. I mean our personal morality. It's incredibly important to be good neighbors to our children and our parents and our friends and our congregation. It simply doesn't work as an escape from public morality also. It seems to me that there is another option, and that other option is to make a commitment to see clearly, to uncover, to begin a lifelong project of becoming economically literate as part of what it means to be a responsible human being, step one. Step two, to be free to lament and grieve and rage at injustice. I have talked with people who have lamented and grieved and raged, and it seems to me very, very biblically real to do so. Look at the Psalms, the lament Psalms that are filled with lament. I have a hunch, and it has paid true, that grief and lament and anger over injustice, if coupled with a will to serve in love, can lead the way into moral and spiritual power. So if we see clearly and we allow ourselves to feel deeply, and third, if we cling to the promises of God, and one of those promises is that we are made into the body of Christ on earth. You know, is that a familiar claim in our churches? The body of Christ on earth. We are, as Luther says, God's hands. As Luther says, God has no other hands on earth. It's us. God works in us and through us, that we are players in a project that is ages old of working as God's people to restore this creation. So what I'm suggesting is the alternative of seeing and feeling and then clinging to the claim that God does work in us to bring justice and to bring compassion. And then fourth, living as if that were true. Practicing ways of life that do begin to build alternatives. That's the alternative that I want to throw out. The alternative to dying in despair or running away or just sinking into private morality. Today, I mean, in these five sessions, we hope to do a little bit of all of those. Now that's the end of the review. Again, apologies to those who were here yesterday. What I would like to do today is that first task of beginning to see more clearly what is going on with economic globalization. Before we move there, are there burning questions or comments that need to be made? I've been talking at you for about 10 minutes or so. Questions that need to be raised or comments made before we go on? And could you say your name before you
speak? I'm Walter Vox from Port Townsend. Could you give a succinct description of globalization?
You must be a plant in the audience because that's the topic we were going to move into.
Well, if you're going to cover that, then I would ask the other thing. When you said about raging, lamenting, grieving, does that render into protest?
Oh, what do you think?
I'm asking you.
I think that rage and lament and grief take many forms. When I teach, I ask people to consider grief and grief as lament, and rage and wonder and awe, to consider those four as leading the way towards living into more just economic lives. I think one of the forms of rage and lament indeed is protest. I think there are many forms of protest. Some are very, very deeply faithful, and some are not. I consider protest, some protest, a form of public witness. The word protest, sometimes I don't like, because many, many kinds of actions gets lumped into one mess. Everything from, you all know, there's everything from very, very faith, we won't go into that, but yes. Other comments, questions that need to come up before we go on? Okay. Well, back to your first question, which is where I did want to go. Globalization is an incredibly messy word right now. It is used to mean almost anything, and whatever it means can be interpreted in different ways. I have begun the practice of not using the word globalization much anymore, but instead talking about the dynamics to which I refer with that word. In the public discourse, globalization sometimes is used very broadly simply to mean interconnectedness between people the world over. Now, it seems to me that the interconnectedness, interdependence, knowing of one another the world over is certainly a part of what we hope for as people, as Christian people. Sisterhood and brotherhood that extends the world over. So when I say globalization, I distinctly do not mean interconnected, the phenomena of interconnectedness. One of the great problems in public discussion today is that people don't say what they mean when they talk about globalization, and then you really can't enter into dialogue. Someone can say, obviously, I'm a critic of economic globalization. If someone says to me, but I think globalization is wonderful. We have exchanges of people the world over. We know about these cultures and that cultures, and that's what they mean by globalization. I say, of course. But that's not what I mean by globalization. So I would say one of the first steps in public discourse, dialogue within our congregations, within our cities about globalization is to say what we mean. I would suggest to you that economic globalization today is characterized by seven defining trends, some of which are extremely obvious and some of which are hidden. And if you could pop on this, this overhead projector, I've written those down. Could someone here move the sheet up a little bit so the word set? Yeah, right there. Can everyone read that?
No.
Maybe could someone turn off the mic? Oh, lovely. Lovely, thank you.
You may want to shut the doors, too.
That line right behind, if somebody could angle that.
That piece of light all over here. Thank you all for doing this. What I've put here is seven defining trends, and I'd like us to go through those one by one, and as we go through them, if we could work to put some flesh on them. And by that I mean, see how these trends play out, one, in your lives, your communities, this country. See how we are familiar with these trends, and then think also about how these trends might play out in countries of the two-thirds world, in many countries of Africa, of Latin America, of the Caribbean. So we'd like to put some flesh on them and think about them in those ways. The first one is probably the most evident, and that is that economic globalization. Wait, don't look at those for a minute. When I say economic globalization, I use it to refer to a couple of other words that I use interchangeably. One of those is corporate and finance-driven globalization. So that suggests that the prevailing paradigm of globalization is driven by, is motivated by, corporate and finance interests. Another word that is used in other continents, not so much this continent, is neoliberal globalization. Another word that is used in other continents is the Washington Consensus, suggesting from the perspectives of many peoples in many parts of the globe that this form of globalization is theoretically and politically undergirded by the United States. These are terms that are used. I just spent time in Geneva at the, is anyone familiar with the World Summit for Social Development? There were a number of world summits, the World Summit for Sustainable Development, that was the Earth Summit. There was one for social development that looked at poverty. And NGOs, that is nonprofit organizations from around the world, were gathered together, literally thousands of people. And as the discussions of poverty went on, they often centered around globalization. And these were words for the dominant paradigm of globalization, of economic globalization, that were used, but are less used in North America. So the first trend, a rapid increase in the movement of goods and services, as well as capital, another word for that would be trade and investment, across international borders. That may be rather self-evident. Just what we often think of as economic globalization, increasing amounts of goods and services and money going across international borders. Can someone just put flesh to that? Give me how you see that happening.
Oh, the oil that gets piped and shipped to here.
Okay. Okay.
NAFTA.
Okay, let's hold on to NAFTA, because in a sense, NAFTA is a treaty that enables that to happen. But that's good. That's good, and don't let us not get back there.
Apples and other local food coming up to Holden.
Oh. Well, there is not so much international borders, because a lot of that is local. Okay. Increasingly Holden.
Apples going to Japan if they let them go in.
or South American apples coming here.
Yeah.
And then what happens to the apple market here? Okay.
That's true.
The McKellen
cars are made of parts from 20 different countries.
Okay. Cars made from parts. If we looked at the tags on our clothes and shoes here, we'd see
Indonesia.
Okay.
Nike has staff people that are just in charge of getting all 117 component parts of one shoe to the right place to get assembled at the right time, and they come from all over.
Okay, that's a lovely example. That's a good example. There was a hand right back there. No. Let's move on to the. Oh yes.
Movies, entertainment, music from Hollywood,
okay.
The Far East, or
okay.
Somewhere.
Cultural goods and services. Very, very good point. In fact, some of the protest against economic globalization in this forum is coming from France. A lot of leadership, and that's because of the cultural trade across international borders. Yes,
the maquiladoras, where people are making Sag Harbor and other kinds of clothing right across the border.
Okay. Okay, clothing parts and
Mexico,
okay.
Electronic technology things from Japan.
Okay, okay. So we see, and look at how there aren't good guys and bad guys in this. I mean, whether you thought this was a constructive or a destructive phenomena, and clearly it's a complex and mixed phenomena, it's all of our lives. It's not just people who work for Nike, it's all of our lives intimately. So there aren't people really implicated and innocent. Or involved and not involved in this phenomenon. Let's look at the second one.
Could I add a word?
Yes.
I would say also information.
Okay, very good.
Because companies now have, like Intel and others, 24 hours around the globe coverage. If you internet with a question, they have teams that when one team's
you talk louder so everybody can hear.
Oh, the information is now 24 hours. There are companies, you know, in Oregon that have teams in other places on the globe such that they pass information to the next team, you know, in the other time zones around the globe so that as these people go off of their shift of work, others are coming on shift in different areas around the globe.
So goods and services take many forms, including, as we've said, information and what were some of the other interesting forms that we mentioned here? Well, anyway, we've...
Media.
Media, culture, right. Name some ways in which there is this rapid increase. A second characteristic of the dominant paradigm of globalization is that a growing portion of the world's largest economies are planned and directed in ways that are not accountable to the public as a whole. Now let's just dig through that a minute. What I'm trying to say, in other words, is that 51 of the world's 100 largest economies today are corporations rather than nations. Now, think, just play into what might be the implications of that. What is the significance of that? Is there anything problematic about that? Is there anything positive about that?
Enron.
Well, all right. Okay. Very good.
But they're, they're accountable to their stockholders, who generally are richer people, some of us probably, on a smaller scale. But because of that, it probably means the rich get richer and the poor get poorer.
Well, that's interesting. You said they're accountable to their stockholders. Now, as I've probed the implications of this, what it has led me to do is study democracy. Because my hunch has been that this doesn't bode well for democracy. When we look at democracy, two of the key, the fundamental principles of democracy are, just half a minute and then I'll call on you right back there, are the accountability of power to a broad public. In a democratic reality, power is supposed to be accountable to a broad public. Secondly, there is supposed to be, in democracy, relative equity in the power to make decisions that affect the common life, particularly decisions that impact who has food, who has water, who has the necessities for a life of dignity. So two cornerstones of democracy are accountability of power and relative equity. Now, we all know that those are goals to be sought after. They're not necessarily realities with which we live, and yet they are principles of democracy. It seems to me that we might need to question what happens when decision-making bodies are accountable, as you said, to shareholders, but not to the broad public. That may be one implication of concern if 51%, if 51 of the largest economies on Earth are corporations. There was a hand up in the back here, and then here, please.
I was going to mention that you talk about democracy, it's in a more capitalism that we're referring to.
Say a little bit more.
Isn't it capitalism that we're referring to in the sense of that's the way we're governed more on the principles of capitalism as opposed to?
Well, that's a lovely question to ask. I would say that's a very important and worthwhile question. I would like us to let the answers to that, musings on that, unravel as we go on. Do you see what I'm saying? I think that we'll get some. If we could all come up with responses to that question by the end of this series, I think we would have done a lot of good work. So let's are we working on, what is the distinction between working on principles of democracy and capitalism, and what principles are governing our life as a body politic? Is that what you're asking?
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Good. Do you mind if we hold it and not try to answer it right at this minute?
Yeah.
Okay. You had a question.
Well, I think another thing these corporations are accountable to stockholders. What the stockholders are asking for are profits, quick profits, very short-term gains, and not a long-term perspective. And a lot of the needs that the world have, at least, are things that require a long-term perspective.
Okay, wow.
Yes.
Now, that's a very profound statement.
If the accountabilities to stockholders and what they are looking for are short-term economic gains, then the longer-term gains that we might expect these corporations to look towards that are really the tied into the solutions for a lot of the problems in the world that are going to go by the wayside.
Okay. There's great truth in that. When I was, some time ago, in fact years ago, working on this, and I was talking to a very high-level corporate manager in a large corporation and talking about corporate-led globalization, and he said the same thing, that how can you be so quick to hold corporations responsible when corporations are run by finance, by the interests of Wall Street. And so I changed my reference to globalization from corporate-driven globalization to corporate and finance-driven for the very reason that you bring up. So if we're looking for economic ways that sustain the long-term public good, and we're demanding of corporations short-term profits, we've got a contradiction that needs to be questioned. Very, very, very good. I have one little problem. I need a little bit of light back on because I can't see my Thank you.
Oh, that was well done, right in the spot.
Let me read to you very briefly. We'll talk more about this, but one of the multilateral, that is many nations involved, agreements that has been percolating and being developed for a few years since, well, I won't give you the exact year, was the MAI, the Multilateral Agreement on Investments. Anyone familiar with that?
All right.
The MAI was an agreement being negotiated in an organization composed of the 29 wealthiest nations, the OECD, the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development. The MAI was being negotiated for about 7 years. I could give you the exact dates. And it was establishing binding mechanisms for enabling corporations. Well, I don't want to get into it right now, but I want to read you a quote.
Okay.
This was a binding agreement that would shape economic life in many ways for nations. The head of the WTO, the World Trade Organization, the person who was the head of it at that time, said this about the MAI. And get it, this MAI was having more far-reaching impact than NAFTA or any of the other trade agreements on the books to date. He said, we are writing, quote unquote, we are writing the now remember the we here is 29, we are writing the constitution of a single global economy. Now, that suggests to me some imbalance of power.
Yes.
The MAI was, when you look back in the negotiation documents, the organizations most consulted with in the process of negotiating it were large corporate networks, the International Chamber of Commerce, the World Council of the Council of World Business Organizations, whatever. So again, this is trying to look at some of the implications of the extent to which accountability and equity in decision making about economic life might be threatened, and democracy might be threatened, if 51 of the 100 largest economies on Earth are not nations which supposedly have the possibility of being democratically governed, but are corporations. Let us move to the third trend up here. The third trend is privatization, by which I mean that increasingly, privatization gives ownership and control of basic goods and services, such as water, electricity, healthcare, education, seeds to corporations or individuals that often are not accountable to the people impacted. Can you put some flesh on that? Where do you or don't you see privatization as a characteristic of economic life today, in our country or elsewhere?
The big one is healthcare.
Healthcare. Okay, who said that? All right. Healthcare in the U.S.
Right, in the U.S.
Not necessarily. That's not as widespread as in many other countries. Okay.
Aren't we the only one that has privatized?
Well, I don't know the data on that, but I know that many.
We are.
You understand we are. Okay. Of industrialized nations. Okay. Yes.
Energy.
Energy, what's an example?
Well, the utility companies have been privatized, and what happened, like when we had the electrical crisis last year in California, and all the companies were trying to maximize their profits and didn't take any consideration the needs of the people there.
Uh-huh, okay. Thank you. Any other examples?
Yes. Land?
Pardon me?
Land.
Land, say more.
Well, I'm just, maybe this isn't necessarily privatization, but especially in our country right now, just the buyout of family farms to major corporations.
Well, that's interesting. The
I don't know what that would that
Well, that's certainly a dynamic going on.
Yeah.
Maybe wouldn't categorize it exactly into privatization because they were already privately owned.
Right.
In other countries, that is very real. In Mexico, does everyone know what NAFTA means? The North American Free Trade Agreement, which was the free trade agreement signed between Canada, the U.S., and Mexico in, 1996, 1997? Pretty recently. Yeah. One of the provisions for Mexico was that they undo the generations-old provisions that peasant populations could have communally held land, or that the communally held land was protected, and so some of that land got privatized. Other examples?
Yes. The radio that we used to think belonged collectively to everyone has been radio and television and the airwaves, the national airways have all been, you know, sold. So that it's difficult to get real information. It's not full of ads and propaganda in a way.
Well, maybe a part of that would be the decreasing amounts of public funds going to public radio. My son's godfather was the president of NPR, and he talked about the implications of decreasing public funds.
But even regular radio that's supposed to be community held, like KBOO is in Portland, more and more are being owned by... I think there's a radio station that's supposed to permeate every place now, the top 100 songs or whatever.
Yeah. Okay, that's clear to me. Thank you. Let's see, others who haven't spoken yet.
Yes.
I have a little twist.
Okay.
I understand that in some countries it's rather difficult to obtain title to land for people that don't already have it. They may be living on land and really, in a sense, it's theirs, but it's very difficult to gain title. If they could, they'd have an asset on which they could perhaps borrow money for business, venture, small, whatever. Mm-hmm. And so that's, a real problem in some countries, some developing countries. Now, that's a little different twist because there you want the privatization because it can maybe increase the well-being, whereas we're looking at it here in a sense of, for example, if water is privatized, you know, who's going to supply the little community out that doesn't have access to it?
Mm-hmm.
Or if the mail is privatized, who's going to serve? So that's a different twist. I don't know if you talk about it later.
Well, no, that is a different twist. And two comments I would have. One is that none of this is, I don't want to use the words black and white because I don't like, you know, we use black and white to mean bad and good, and that doesn't work. But none of it is as clear cut. And there are certainly nuances that are much, much deeper and present than are acknowledged in a one-hour discussion. I would also say, in reference to what you're saying, that the effort, in my experience, and this is my experience, the effort of very poor people to get land, title to land, isn't privatization because the land that they're trying to get is already privately owned. It's privately owned. At least in my experience in Honduras, land was privately owned by large, large entities, and small people were trying to get it, which would be a different kind of transfer, similar to the one that was being talked about over here.
I had gotten in my head that some of that land is government land that people couldn't put their hands on.
That very well may be.
But I don't know that exactly.
We have publicly held lands here for grazing.
Sure.
Yeah, that's not available to everybody, but... My son does not have much money, but he still bought a house, you know, was able, that's getting private,
right.
Private land.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I want to throw out a couple of other examples. Oh, yes.
Mm-hmm. You know, there's a company called Texas Utilities that bought the Energy Group, which is an electric company in London. And they are providing electric service, obviously, to Londoners out of Texas. And there's a company called Scottish Power that bought Pacific Corp in Oregon, Washington, Idaho, and Wyoming, and they provided electricity for the Olympics, just included.
Okay, so a Texas-based company is providing electricity for London, and a Scottish-based company is providing electricity for the Olympics in the U.S. Is that what you just said? So that's a great example. And the question that we need to ask is, what are the implications of that on the well-being of people's lives? What are the implications for the extent...
They can stop giving it.
Well, what are the implications for the extent to which people have some control over the resources that shape their lives? That's a wonderful example. I want to give a couple of others, and then I do want to move on. What I have been moved to think about is the privatization of water. It has been said that the wars of the next decade will be over water rather than oil. That water is the scarce resource on the horizon, and not only on the horizon, but already existing. If such is the case, and if it is true, as it is, that increasingly water sources that were public are being privatized and commodified, sold, then what are the implications for people who can't pay the price? A couple of examples of privatization of water. Under NAFTA, and again, that was the North American Free Trade Agreement, under a clause in NAFTA, an Alaska-based water company, I think it was Sunbelt Water, was trying to export, or was exporting, water from British Columbia. British Columbia put a moratorium on the purchase and export of its water, the privatization of its water and the sale of it. Under NAFTA, Sunbelt was able to sue Canada, because a clause in NAFTA allows a corporation to sue a government if the government takes an action that reduces its profits. Sunbelt sued Canada for $400 million in
what?
So that's just a little example. Another example, but I think did I give the example about South America, the city in South America yesterday?
No, but I saw it on a TV channel. I couldn't remember which country.
Well, the water supply around Cochabamba, which is a fairly good-sized city, was privatized, was sold to the highest bidder, which was, I believe, a British-based company. Very shortly after that happened, water prices went up as much as 300% for the very poorest people for whom water had been almost free, which meant that those people couldn't buy water, couldn't get water. And for any of you who have experience in the two-thirds world, if you don't have clean water, you can't support the lives of little children. Little babies don't survive without clean water. So this example of the privatization of water result was death dealing for the poorest of the poor. Now the flip side of that is that tremendous organizing went on in Cochabamba, around Cochabamba, and was supported internationally. Now here is, really, thanks to globalization as intercommunication, people knew about it right away, and the decision was overturned. The sale was undone. But that's just a dramatic example of what we need to think about when we think about the implications of privatization. Can we move on to the next one?
Mm-hmm.
Let's see, we have only 15 more minutes.
Yeah, we've got to keep going.
Okay, we'll move along. A fourth trend is the accelerating commodification of life experiences and life forms. Life forms might be genetic materials. Life experiences might be cultural experiences. When I say commodification, I'm referring to placing a monetary value on something and marketing it. So again, just to play that out a little bit, what's an example of the commodification of a life form or a life experience? Yes?
The people of Iceland have a remarkably pure DNA, and it's their
strength. Can you speak up just a little
bit? Remarkably pure DNA, and in their structure, their life, that DNA prototype is the basis of some of these gene strains that are now being circulated for disease cures and genetic defect cures and that sort of thing. And they are... Individuals can sell that, they can trade it, but also if it's harmed by a corporation, if you were in a study group, then you lose the right to your own genetic material. You no longer own that.
So making genetic material into a commodity buying and selling it, and you've taken a step further, patenting it, so that it can no longer be owned except by those who own the patent.
That's right.
Okay, genetics, that's a very good example. I didn't know about the Icelandic example.
And how about travel, the experiential type thing? People traveling so much, you know, to experience an area that perhaps in the shifting of resources from tourism trade, then no longer the local people, there could be issues.
And remember, that brings up some of the complexities too, because many communities are seeking tourist trade. And yet you can also see, let's hold on to that. There are complexities in that we could look at pros and cons of. But I think part of what you're talking about is that cultures then, cultural experiences get sold. You can buy a sweat lodge experience.
Yes.
You can buy, what other cultural experiences can you buy?
You can go on a space shuttle. You can go on a spaceship. You can go on a... Okay. You have the money, you can do it.
I hadn't thought about that.
Well, they have done it. 2 billion years have done it.
Okay, good. Other examples? Yes, in the past, or is that someone holding up a thread? That's Alex and his mini. Okay. Just think for a minute, or am I wrong? Is there not a trend toward commodification of life experience? I mean, and this, again, there's a lot of nuance. I realize that in my own life, certain things are commodified that I'm grateful for, and yet I'm not so sure about it. To see a therapist. You know, at one time, to get wise counsel, that's not a good example, but to get wise counsel now, I don't want to step on the wrong territory here. Many things we now pay for that once upon a time didn't have to be paid for. And I wonder, one has to wonder about that. Believe me, I think good therapy is the best money I've ever spent. So I'm not saying that we shouldn't
be living advisors, maybe that's what.
But I'm saying that there are things that we now turn into commodities that once weren't. I'd like someone to come up with something else that you know of in terms of
commodification. We're becoming service oriented. We're paying for services. As a society, more than we are for things.
Well, that's a true trend. Uh-huh.
I'm thinking of in earlier times. This is picking up on the previous lecture here. I want to go out and climb Mount Rainier on one's own. Mm-hmm. Just get a group of people and climb Mount Rainier. Mm-hmm. But there are restrictions today, and in almost all cases, you have to go with a guide to whom you pay so much money to climb Mount Rainier. Come back down again safely.
Okay.
That's commodifying the climb of Mount Rainier.
Well, we're coming up with a lot of stuff here. I want to take one more from someone who hasn't spoken, and then we're going to move on. Yes, in the back. That's you.
I don't know your name. Two things. One, I'm a therapist, and I support your view of that. You're absolutely right. That's the stuff that should happen in your community, but you can do it anymore. But the other one I was thinking of was Monsanto and the corn that they grow can't be seeded. And that's just blatantly evil.
Okay, and what you're
doing for years.
What is it?
They've been doing it for years.
So are you talking about, may I broaden a little bit what you're talking about, or what I think? Monsanto is a seed company that is now in the practice, as are other seed companies, of going into countries, say India, and taking a strain of Indian rice that may have been developed over centuries by a particular people in a particular part of India, genetically modifying the strain a tiny little bit, and then patenting that strain of rice so that Indians who now want, and then buying it up, and then Indian farmers who have used it forever, in order to plant that seed strain, need to pay to use it because it's patented. So it's the commodification of a seed strain that once was used season after season by the Indian people, and then took another step forward that the seeds are now being developed so that they won't reseed themselves. So they'll only seed once.
And secondly, so that they will only see themselves if they are accompanied by a particular chemical that is also produced by the same company. So that's an example of the commodification of seeds. Many Indian people who are on the forefront, India is on the forefront of some of this protest, call that biopiracy as a new form of piracy. But that's an example. Am I talking about what you were talking about?
Yes.
Much more eloquent. No, not more eloquent, but I'm sitting where I have space to put the voice up. Yes. Let us move on very quickly and then see where we need to go next. Fifth, we'll just zap through these. The strategic marketing of Western consumer-oriented ways of life around the world. That's probably pretty self-evident. One of the examples that I see is the increasing efforts of both automobile industry and refrigeration industry to make sure that, quote unquote, every Chinese person has a car and a refrigerator. So then you think, what happens to the ozone layer if every Chinese person has a car and a refrigerator? Let's move on. The commodification of money. By the commodification of money, and I'm calling that the sixth trend, let me just summarize that briefly by reading a summary of it. The commodification of money simply means that speculative trade in money products for short-term gain outpaces trade in goods and services and outpaces investment in production-oriented economic activity. That trend, by the way, is affirmed or stated by analysts across the spectrum. Conservative, I can read you statements by quote-unquote conservative analysts and very, very liberal analysts who are talking about, because the figures show that that there is more trade in money for short-term gain than other trade in goods and services. The commodification of money, together with a revolution in communication and information technology, enables huge amounts of money to be bought and sold across national borders instantly by investors who aren't accountable to the communities impacted by the money coming in and out. Now, the implications of that trend are enormous. When you think about the Mexican peso, when it fell in the 90s, that was because of money going in and then coming out again. I worked closely with a Korean theologian who spoke to this trend, and I want to read very briefly his words. A Christian theologian from Korea. He said, I quote, "Suddenly in November 1997, foreign investors, panicked by the Asian currency crisis, demanded their dollars back, and lenders called in their short-term loans. Koreans say that this is the most tragic event ever since the Korean War. Korea is now plunged into a stormy night of company bankruptcies, mass layoffs, and more. A layoff in a household means a death sentence to one's family in Korea. Those who have found no way out of the slump have committed suicide, sometimes a familial suicide. The only winners in Korea are the foreign banks, who will get their money back and then some."
And that's a saving face thing that happens in many countries.
That indeed may be. The voice was simply to illustrate the impact of this fast movement of money. Money being used as a product to buy and sell, rather than money being what it once was, which was something with which to buy and sell. It's money becoming a commodity, a product. Now, those of you who listen to public radio, read mainstream journals, are seeing that even very mainstream economic analysts are questioning this, are saying that we need capital controls, we need public policies that say you can't just buy and sell in an instant currencies for the purpose of buying it cheap and selling it high. But I would throw that out to you as a sixth trend. A seventh trend, and we won't talk about this at length because I want to go into another moment. The seventh trend is just the increasing power of economic players relative to democratic countries, democratic governance bodies, in order to enable these developments by freeing transnational trade and investment from regulations and other constraints that might diminish profit. Let me interpret that. It just means that increasingly there are international and multinational agreements that give large, large corporations the capacity to override the rules and regulations of governments, be they nations or localities, in the economic interests of the corporations. One of those agreements was NAFTA. There are many others out there. One was the MAI that I mentioned earlier, and we'll talk more about that. Many states, many cities in the U.S. declared themselves, believe it or not, MAI free zones. Seattle became an MAI free zone. Many, many local and state and provincial governments said this isn't good for us, and we want to block it, and stood up to block it. And the MAI was eventually undone in its current form. We will, and I believe it's day after tomorrow, maybe it's tomorrow, just talk more about the implications of these kinds of agreements, because they're on the boards right now, and people, the publics of the world have a chance to impact them. I kid you not that the MAI was being negotiated literally in secret. The U.S. Congress became aware of it. I have a letter signed by 27 U.S. Congress people saying, what on earth is going on that this is being negotiated without congressional oversight and input? But when the MAI became uncovered, and it was uncovered by folks in Canada and France, information of it was circulated around the world, and publics around the world stopped the MAI in that form, although it now has other forms. This is so little time to do so much. These are simply to throw out to you what some would understand to be a way of formulating, a way of dissecting, a way of pinpointing some of the dynamics that go on. That are going on in the prevailing form of economic globalization. What I had wanted to do, and what we will do for just 3 or 4 minutes, is to recall that this form of globalization is the result of human decisions and actions. It's not inevitable, it doesn't have to be, it's what human beings have decided. And anything that is the result of human decisions and actions can be changed, transformed, resisted, we can go other directions. Alternatives to this form of globalization are on the boards. People are talking about them and developing the world over, including people at very high, high influential positions in society and people at the very grassroots. So we must remember, although in our context, the U.S., the conversation in the public is much less and much smaller, so we're not aware of the many alternatives. One of the most untold stories of the last decade truly is people the world over developing and beginning to practice and promote alternatives to this form of global economy. I would like us, or those of us who continue to come together for this discussion this week, to be probing alternatives. I am convinced that it's a true moral wrong to ask people to look at systemic injustice, systemic economic problems, to look clearly without also looking at the fact that there are alternatives. What I would like us to do is to be thinking about, we will think further about what makes us buy into this system, but I'd like us also to be thinking about alternatives in 4 forms. I want us to be thinking about basic principles for economic life that might be guidance if part of the great work of people today is to restructure the global economy, as one of our earlier quotes said, then what are some principles for economic life that might help us to restructure? And then in looking at those, I'd like us also to look at, we were gonna do it over here on paper today. I want us to look at principles. And some of you may have been thinking and studying about this and have some of those in your mind. I'll present four that I've been working with. And then just think about public policies that would realize those principles or work towards them. And then think about lifestyle practices that would cohere with those principles. And then think about public forms of public witness. By that I mean sometimes, well, we'll think about various forms of public witness that cohere with principles that could undergird a more just and sustainable form of economic life. Over it all, I would ask you to keep in mind what I consider to be two moral norms for Christians in thinking about economic life. One of those norms is justice-making neighbor love. Now, get it that when I and many people, and maybe many of you, read the call to love neighbor in light of the life of Jesus and the stories of God and the Hebrew people, it looks like neighbor love includes making justice. In other words, part of love is to seek justice for the oppressed. So one norm for economic life for Christian peoples is justice-making neighbor love. Justice-making neighbor love. A second norm for economic life for Christian people today is sustainable earth-human relations. By which I mean that now, because of the developments of the last 40 years, economic life needs to contribute to a relationship between our species and the planet that is sustainable, that can sustain life for generations to come. If we would bear in mind those two norms, justice-making neighbor love and sustainable earth-human relations as our overall guides for economic life, then let's think about what principles might cohere with those guides. And then we'll think about practices and policies and public witness that could bring those principles into reality. Does that make any sense? Or are there questions, comments, concerns about that?
Sounds good. I put a fifth P on there.
What's the fifth P?
Prayer.
Oh, well, thank you very much. Let's think about that. And that's well, of course. And I didn't even notice that they were all P's, honestly.
But it's pretty cool.
But they are. Okay, thank you. Thank you. If we had more time, well, no, do put that. And when we put prayer, it would also be important to extend that to both our prayer, our worship, our practice of the Eucharist, our practice of baptism. How can all of those undergird neighbor love in our economic lives? Partly I say that because when I have studied Luther and studied what undergirds Luther's claims that economic life can serve neighbor love and must serve neighbor love, some of the practices that he names that empower people to love neighbor, one of them is prayer. One of them is the Eucharist. So how could prayer and worship and Eucharist undergird and support and sustain and nurture our capacity to live out neighbor life in our economic lives? Thank you for that addition. Thank you. Okay, well, what we're going to do in the next, we'll close in 1 minute. What we're going to do from here forth is, in the next session, take a look at the notion of growth. It's the notion of economic growth as a good for everybody that really undergirds globalization. And let's look at that. Where is economic growth good and where isn't it? Next, we're going to, on the fourth day, look at the notions of freedom and democracy and how they relate to economic globalization. And then finally, we'll look a little bit more at Luther's economic ethics and how they might teach us about economic life. And all along, I hope to be having us construct. We're going to put up some pieces of paper and construct some lists of policies and practices, of principles and policies and practices and public witness. And I would like you all, if you can keep this in mind, if you plan to come to any more of these sessions, to bring with you symbols of hope. If you can, in the day, in the next 24 hours, be aware of where you see hope. Hope that we can live as if we can love neighbors in our economic lives. And just bring symbols of hope, and we'll place them along with the candle in our circle. Thank you.
What time tomorrow?
Oh, I don't know. Is tomorrow Thursday? 10:45. 10:45. Thank you.